Okay, in the effort of time, yesterday I had a debrief with Andrew, and I made modifications to all the slides based on what we discussed yesterday. So the agenda I'm going to go through real quick: what is ergonomics, what are the risk factors, what's a successful ergonomics program look like, because everybody seems to be talking about it, but nobody's talking about the specifics. What are the tools, methods, guidelines, general solutions, and then case studies where that I've been involved with. So, you know, what is ergonomics? It's the interaction between people and their work environment. It is the science of fitting work to people. Okay, to do that, what do we need to know? What are the capabilities of people? What are the limitations of people? What are the demands of work, whether it be physical or cognitive? And is there a match or mismatch between the two? Okay, the goal of ergonomics is to improve the quality and the productivity of the work environment while maximizing the safety, health, and well-being of the employee. So this is ergonomics at work. We know that people have known limitations, and we build around that. Okay, so what are the ergonomic risk factors? There's five of them. Awkward postures, you know, bending, twisting, reaching. Static postures, maintaining those awkward postures for long periods of time. Forceful exertions, you know, gripping, pinching, material handling, lifting, pushing, pulling, carrying. Repetitive motions, contact stress where soft body parts are in contact with something that's sharp or hard, or using a body part as a hammer. And then vibration, which can be whole body or hand-arm vibration. Am I talking really quick? Okay, just because you have risk factors does not mean you're going to get carpal tunnel syndrome. Okay, it's the relationship between risk factors and injuries is very complex. Okay, the risk of injury depends on the duration, you know, how long you do something, the frequency, you know, how often, the intensity, how much, and then the combinations of risk factors. Okay, so you know this is what successful ergonomic programs are all about. For the people that cannot read the bottom, it says. Can everybody read the bottom? It says, come on, keep those stomachs over the handle. Let the fat do the work. Okay. Okay, so when you look at successful ergonomic programs, there's four key elements that we teach. The first is what they call risk management. Look, is being able to recognize, evaluate, control, and prevent problems. Okay. Versus consequence management, which is wait for something to happen, wait for somebody to have an injury, wait for an accident, you know, you wait for people to get old, and then you do something about it. The second one is identify and understand root cause of problems to make effective improvement solutions. A lot of times, I'm a consultant, so I get called in when companies have challenges. They've tried things with ergonomics, they struggle with it. And the biggest problem is they do not implement effective improvements. You know, like, for example, somebody implements floor mats, but their biggest problem is material handling. That doesn't really solve their problem. The second thing is to integrate into what we call operational excellence, and that's lean manufacturing, Six Sigma. How many people in here know are doing that? A few people? Okay. This was brought up this morning, and they talk about there's a lot of negativity around lean and Six Sigma and things like that, where, you know, letting workers go and things. We have a saying, it's called doing more with less. Lean, ergonomics, and Six Sigma is what LESS stands for. So integrating people into those systems to make improvements. And then I think Mike mentioned this morning is at the end of the day, it's all about business. And it's about, you know, making money, showing value to the shareholders. So your ergonomic improvements need to demonstrate that value. You know, what's the results of what you're doing? So when you look at reactive programs, or what they call consequence management, you see at the top is your musculoskeletal injury. Prior to an injury, you're going to have pain, you're going to have discomfort, people are going to have difficulty doing a job. These are all what we call the reactive things. That's where you wait for something to happen. And you can see from my chart here, below this line is ergonomic risk factors. And then human limitations forms the foundation of that pyramid. So when you look at reactive ergonomic programs, what you see is injuries and employees drive the program. Okay, you solve one problem at a time. You want to address Johnny's back injury. There's a high amount of effort. Ergonomics is usually a team or a single person. I don't think too many people are in this audience are lucky to have an ergonomist on staff. But usually, you know, somebody in health and safety, it's HR. There's generally no quantitative risk assessment methods, and there's no measure of the impact of what you're doing. Okay. So the question now is, how do you become proactive? How do you build in ergonomics and human limitations into the design of your workplace? Okay, so this is what we call a proactive state. You want to workstations and equipment and jobs are improved before an injury or an illness or an employee complaint. You want to use the risk management approach. So you go out, you identify risks, and then you make improvements based on the risk. You don't wait for an accident to happen. Workstations with the same risks are improved through what we call design templates, best practice guidelines, or even technology, using like the web and things like that. So the idea there is, we call it form, fix once, repeat many. So the idea is once you solve one problem, now you should, every time you see that problem, you should implement that improvement. Okay. Generally in the beginning, there's a high amount of effort because you have to train people, you have to internalize the program, create that sort of culture. And then the other thing is ergonomics needs to be integrated into all aspects of the operation. It should not be a health and safety issue alone. It needs to be an engineering issue. It needs to be a purchasing issue. It needs to be an HR issue. It needs to be integrated into all aspects of the operation. You want to do quantitative risk assessment methods. You want to measure the impact of what you're doing. And then at the end, you want to document the results. Okay? Any questions so far? Am I talking too quick? Okay, so if you look at various tools and methods, there's a lot. And I don't want to complicate things, but basically what you want to do is you want to take a look at where you're at. So at the very bottom is what I call basic principles. Just go out there and look at stuff. Look at risk. Based on everything that we've talked about, I'll call this ergonomics 101. If you know that things shouldn't be on the floor, they should be at least at knee level, just go out and every time you see something on the floor, raise it up. Okay, really simple thing to do. As you progress, you want to go into different methods. So the next stage would be what they call screening tools. So you'd look at, like a simple checklist. Okay, is the wrist bent more than 45 degrees of, wrist extension, right, like this? Or is the person lifting more than 50 pounds? That's sort of like a screening tool. And then as you progress up, you get into what they call semi-quantitative tools, which, again, you're looking at more, gathering more data. You're measuring risk, you're measuring frequencies, things like that. And there's various tools and methods over here. And then it gets up to more quantitative. And at the very top is what I call objective-based measurement, where you're using like electromyography, electrogoniometry, measuring heart rate, very complicated things. And some people do that. I actually did a project with a bus company, and that's what we did. We measured EMG, electrogoniometry, whole body vibration, video of bus drivers, because they've already done everything else. And they just could not get the results they were looking for because they didn't measure it. Real quick, here's different tools and methods. Simple checklists. Here's sort of a screening tool. You can see there's various body parts, various risk factors. And then this is more of a detailed tool where you're actually looking at, force frequencies, ranges of motion, things like that. This is biomechanical models. And this is something that's unique that we use is human CAD modeling, where you can take a design, you can put people into the CAD program, and then you can see how they can interact and they can move. Can the short person fit? Can the tall person fit? Can the short person reach? And then you can go backwards and say, what's the risk of this design? And make improvements. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but basically at the end of it, what do these tools and methods do? Is they allow you to do what they call risk mapping. So you can go out, you can look at all your operations, and then you can see at a glance, where do I have risk? And the operation, I color coded here, red, yellow, green, red being high risk. So at a glance, you can see, where should I put most of my effort? So you start with the high risk first. So what this allows you to do is you can identify jobs that have unnecessary repetitive motions, awkward body positions, or high force applications that can have an effect on an older worker. Okay. Why do we use risk assessment tools? A few reasons. First, it eliminates or aligns ergonomics with the accepted risk management approach. It eliminates what we call the ready, fire, aim approach that sometimes you see in ergonomics. People just go out there and do things. It provides a baseline in which action is required. As they say, if you can't measure it, you cannot manage it. Eliminates the ergonomics program, ensures the ergonomics program will reach its stated goals of, let's say, a 20% risk reduction might be a good goal. And then also aligns the organization and allows you to communicate the what, the why, and the how things are going to get done. And at the end of it, it's a management tool to allow you to measure the overall impact of what your ergonomics program. So when you look at different tools, methods, guidelines out there, there's not a lot of things on the aging worker, interesting enough. Sort of some of the common things that you'll see under strength, NIOSH has a lifting equation. Anybody familiar with the NIOSH lifting equation? A couple people. Okay. It's been around for like 20, 30 years now, I guess. But basically, NIOSH has this formula that says, okay, you're on a lifting task, here's how you can assess it, here's what we recommend as a safe limit, which is basically around 23 kilograms or a disc compression of 3,400 newtons. There's some work out of the University of Waterloo, McGill, and they have some guidelines on shear forces on the spine. Now, the interesting thing is sort of these are sort of the standards within ergonomics, but there's a couple researchers here that actually went out and they did studies on gender and age. And they looked at how does your disc, what does the compression change? How does it change with age? And here's what this graph shows is when you're 30, your disc can withstand a pressure of about 900 kilograms. This is laboratory studies where they take actually your disc and your ligaments and they crush them. They see how much force can the body withstand. And then they did studies on 60-year-old spines and they see that these numbers go down. So it kind of makes sense that with age, your bones change, your disc change, so maybe your ergonomic guidelines should change. How did that get out of there? So that's some of the things that are out there. Other strength things are what they call less than 25% maximum voluntary contraction. And what I mean by that is if you look at your maximum force that you can exert, general ergonomic guidelines should be you should only be exerting 25% of that. Okay, so for example, if you can lift 100 pounds, theoretically you should only be less than 25. Okay, that's really simplified, but that's what that is. When you look at posture, there's some general guidelines out there that you should be within 1/3 to 50% of your total range of motion. Okay, so that's some guidelines out there. And then when you look at endurance, there's this thing called relative aerobic strain, and they actually recommend that you should be less than 50%, okay? And that is if you have breaks. If you have jobs that do not require breaks and don't allow people to have breaks, you should be much less. It should be closer to 33%, okay? All right, so this is an interesting thing. I ran some numbers last night, and sort of what NIOSH says, NIOSH is kind of like the gold standard for lifting. That's this green line here. They say anything below that line is considered safe. 99% of men, 75% of women should be able to safely lift that object. This red line is what they call high risk. And they say, 1% of the population can do that. That requires engineering fixes. Nobody should be able to do that job. The interesting thing is these two other researchers, the blue and the sort of this lime green color, that's the research that they've taken into account gender and age. And what you see, obviously, is 20, you're much higher than what NIOSH recommends. And it's up to about 45 years of age is where the number crosses. So one would assume that the NIOSH lifting equation can effectively protect a workforce less than 45. Okay? And then as you see, as the workforce increases, this number goes down, actually goes into a negative at, 85? Okay? So the question comes up is, should you change your guidelines and recommendations for an aging workforce? And based on some of these models, you see that it kind of makes sense. Okay, is that clear? Makes sense? Okay. Interesting. So this is what I did. I don't need to look at it. Another interesting thing is posture is a huge predictor of injury or a huge predictor of force. Okay, and there's this model, biomechanical model at the University of Waterloo, and what it allows you to do is you can manipulate somebody's spine. You can change spine position, they call it. Okay? They call it lordosis, which is like maintaining the curve in your back, and then kyphosis is rounding your back. Okay, and this model allows you to do that, and that's kind of what these little circles show here. So basically, you take, let's say, a stoop position versus a squatting type position, and what you see, that's what the stoop K and the stoop L is, that the shear forces, which is a slipping action, so compression is pushing together, and a shear is a sliding motion on the spine, that when you do not maintain what they call lordosis, or the natural curve of your spine, the forces are way above the maximum acceptable limit. But when you do maintain proper spine position, those forces go way below safe limits. So what's the sort of the take-home message here? Right. Yeah, lordosis. Posture is a huge predictor of the risk of injury. Okay. Another thing, when you look at age, there's this International Labor Organization. It's out of the UK, and they actually put together some guidelines. This is, I won't tell you how old this guideline is, but it goes back to the 60s. And they actually put together basic recommendations on how much weight somebody can safely lift based on their age. And what you see is, for the most part, when you're 25 years of age, it lines up pretty closely with what NIOSH recommends, about 25 kilograms, 23 kilograms. And then as your age increases, that number decreases by 30 to 40%. Okay? Interesting. There's another one that's out there. This was actually published in the Ergonomics Journal in 1997. Interesting enough, nobody uses it. but I anticipate that it's going to become more common. And it's what they call a lifting capacity formula. It's very, without getting into the details, it's very similar to the NIOSH lifting equation, with the exception is an age factor. You can basically figure out how much somebody can lift, and you can say, okay, the worker's 25 or they're 55, and should that number change? And basically, this is the multiplier. So you can see at 20, you get a 1, so there's no change. And then as that age increases, let's say up to 60, you're down to 0.5% reduction in the weight that somebody can effectively lift. Okay. So there's a few things out there. The other thing that's interesting, how many people were not here yesterday? Okay, well, you missed some good stuff. I had a few slides yesterday showing about strength and cardiovascular and all these different changes. So what you see here is when you look at what they call your maximum ability basically decreases, of course, as a function of age. And the interesting thing is your work demands may stay the same. Okay? So what happens is as you increase in age, your reserve, or the percent of reserve that's left, changes. So as you get up here to maybe 70, you get basically no reserve left. Okay? So... which is interesting. So then when you look at work capacity from a cardiovascular perspective, this is what they call your maximum oxygen uptake, how much oxygen you can take in. Obviously peaks around, actually it decreases with age. But the ergonomic recommend guidelines is less than 50%. Okay, so basically you have a reserve. So that allows people to recover from the work and they're not overstraining themselves. So something I'm going to throw out here is should your work demands decrease with decreasing strength and decreasing work capacity? So this is kind of what this shows. If you know this is going down, should your work demands, instead of being straight across, should they decrease with age to allow for that reserve? Okay? I'm just throwing it out there. We are on my answer to that. So interesting. So if you were to do this, the challenge is, okay, well, how do you do that? And there's just basically, I think, two solutions. One is you want to decrease the peak workloads, or decrease the workload by cutting the peak amount. So sometimes you look at jobs where, and that bus driver was a good example, where they have peak loads that are above or really close to somebody's 100% max. So that's the idea, is you want to reduce that or build in more breaks to allow people to recover quickly. Or recover more effectively. So those are two things that you could do from the sort of the work design perspective. The second one would be to increase the fitness level of the employees to be able to withstand that work demand. So since I only have 1 minute left, I'll stop here. All right, so has everybody had a good lunch? Post-lunch dip, everybody's going to... I didn't make the lunch. All right, so continuing on with this presentation here, I thought I'd go into real basics, some different types of solutions that are available. and then getting some case studies. And in the effort of time, again, I might skip through some of this pretty quick. But when you start talking about how to deploy effective improvement solutions, I like to use something called the MAIC process, which basically Six Sigma, very good. Which basically says, you know, define your problems, go out and you measure your problems, analyze potential solutions, implement those solutions, and then control those problems from happening in the future. Okay, so you know, here's an example. This is a company that we did some work with, and it's a medical device company. And what they had to do is they're clamping and declamping these basically these bands on these wires here. And sort of we defined the problem, the history of injuries. 75% of the people that do this job are hurt. Okay, guess why? Because it takes 80 pounds of grip force to squeeze the clamp. Okay, so anybody know anything about strength? 80 pounds of grip force is more than most women can do, and is probably about 80, 90% of what most men can do. Okay, so a very high grip strength. The pinch force is about 18 pounds of pinch force. Just to put it in perspective, that's over 100% of what women can do, and it's probably about 95% of what most men can do. They do this 100 times per shift, and then the force to remove the clamps was impacted by the variability of the force because it was a manual application. So no wonder they had problems, okay? So the solution here, now, really, is the interesting thing is how this became a problem, not because they were hurting people, is because there was nobody left that could do it. Because the force was so high, they kept putting men on this job, and then some of these men that had the strength that could do it, they got hurt. And they're like, uh-oh, everybody else here is, you know, a lot of small females that don't have that strength. Now what are we going to do? Right? That's right. So the idea was a pneumatic clamper, okay? We suspended overhead. It was foot actuated. The interesting thing is you take that, where's my scanner? You take the wrist from, let's say, 80 pounds of grip force down to 10. Okay, everybody can exert 10 pounds of grip force. That's probably equivalent to holding a large cup of coffee. Okay, but it was an 88% reduction in the risk. Okay, so we'll get into what I call the physical ergonomic rules of work. So when you look at reaching, there's lots of design guidelines on measurements and things like that. But to keep it real simple, things that you do frequently should be within what they call a forearm sweep. So if I have my arms at my side, this is a forearm sweep.